It's Friday, January 1st, and this is VOA's International Edition. Happy New Year. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, a huge hotel fire in Dubai marks the new year. Islamic State is pushed out of Ramadi.
What climate change does is it takes events that would have been, you know, extreme events and makes them not just extreme, but unprecedented.
Extreme weather has been intense around the world. What's causing it? Also ahead, we'll take a look at some very special Chinese art in New York. It's all coming up on today's International Edition. The new year has been welcomed with fireworks displays and festivities across the world, and one of the largest is in Dubai, where hundreds of thousands of people witnessed not only fireworks at midnight, but a huge fire engulfing a high-rise luxury hotel near the Burj Khalifa, which is the tallest building in the world. All residents had been evacuated from the 63-floor address hotel after it became consumed in flames late Thursday. Initial reports say at least 14 people were hurt. One of those witnesses was VOA United Nations correspondent Margaret Bashir, who is spending the holiday in Dubai. She joins us now from near the address hotel. Margaret, where were you and what were you doing as the fire broke out?
I was having dinner tonight for the new year, just under the Burj Al Khalifa, which is the tallest building in the world, and where they have the spectacular fireworks show planned. And we had dinner in a restaurant out on the terrace near the fountains. They have fountains like the Bellagio Hotel in Las Vegas, for instance. And then the address hotel where the fire broke out is about 1,000 meters maybe or a little bit more away from the Burj Al Khalifa, separated by one of the world's biggest shopping malls. And at about 9:30 local time, the fire started, and it spread very rapidly up the building.
That's what we have heard from other eyewitnesses, that this was an extremely fast-moving fire.
I couldn't believe how quickly we were. First, we just looked up from our table and said, oh, my goodness, there's a fire. And then all of a sudden, the whole building was engulfed. So it was really quite shocking to see. And there's smoke and fire still billowing from the buildings. And it's actually, the smoke is blowing towards the Burj Al Khalifa now. But the whole north side of the address hotel, which is a very five-star luxury hotel where I'm sure many people were celebrating New Year's Eve because it has such a wonderful view of the fireworks show. Seeing it looked quite terrible, and you wondered how people were going to evacuate.
What was the immediate reaction where you were? Were officials on the scene quickly? Were they trying to move people out? Did people stay in place?
Yes. There were hundreds of security present all day long in downtown Dubai and hundreds of security in the mall itself and on the area on the esplanade near the fountains, and they really did move rapidly. About maybe 15 minutes after the fire really got raging, they started moving people indoors because there was flaming debris falling off of the hotel. It wouldn't have hit where we were sitting, but it probably could have hit some of the people in restaurants that were a bit closer to the hotel. And the authorities, you know, made everybody move inside. The people were very orderly. I was afraid with so many thousands of people in the area, there could be some sort of a stampede situation, but the authorities seemed to have really managed the crowds quite well.
And a lot of people indeed were outside waiting for that spectacular fireworks display, perhaps the biggest and best in the world for New Year's, and that went ahead.
It did. They were going to have it in several places in the Emirate of Dubai as well as in the other Emirates of the United Arab Emirates. So, and Burj Al Arab is where midnight kickoff was to happen, and they still went ahead with it, and we actually were told to leave the restaurant at around 11:30, and so we proceeded out through parking garages and things to avoid the hotel, and we were in the street with thousands of other people, and they were cheering when the fireworks started. They were very happy that the show went on.
And life does go on, despite these horrific things that happen from time to time, but we're certainly glad that you are safe, and you had quite a vantage point to this event.
Oh, boy. Yeah, it was certainly not the kind of exciting evening we were anticipating.
Well, we thank you so much, Margaret, for taking a little bit of time out in the wee hours of the morning to speak with us, and we hope you have a wonderful New Year while you're there.
Yeah, Happy New Year to everyone who's listening. Thanks, Jim.
Well, staying in Dubai, International Edition's G. Abby Lee joins us now in the studio to bring us online reactions to our top story. Hello, G.
Hi, Jim.
What are some of the updates on the fire?
I've been following the CNN Breaking News Twitter account at CNNBRK, probably not as close as Margaret did, but the latest news is from 2 hours ago, and it reads like this. Dubai carries on with hashtag New Year's Eve fireworks as hotel fire rages. Online media giant Mashable also tweeted about it, attaching a CNN photo. The tweet reads like this. New Year's fireworks in Dubai, where a fire engulfed a 63-story hotel today.
Well, what's the public reaction like on this? I mean, this is quite an event that has happened.
Exactly. Now, many people are commenting that this may not be the most sensitive decision made by Dubai authorities, and these are some of the comments on the CNN tweet. A Twitter user named Andy Ango wrote this. They are still hosting celebrations. Yeah, richest country on earth, which is not true, by the way, but that boasting is insensitive in light of this. Another comment was a more practical concern. A user with last name Lyons tweeted, what's happening to the hotel guests and residents? Are they just wandering the streets? Sure, it's hard to find the room.
Well, speaking of which, I was wondering about that too. Mm-hmm. Is the Dubai government tweeting about the safety of the hotel guests?
It really is. The government of Dubai has a PR Twitter account at DXB Media Office, and it tweeted updates about both the accident and fireworks Thursday.
Oh, wow. So what did you find there?
The account tweeted that the country's tourism department will provide the hotel guests with alternative accommodation, and it also counted there were 14 minor injuries, one moderate and one heart attack case because of overcrowding and smoke at the fire site. Jim, the account tweets in both Arabic and English, and in addition to the update of the fire accident, it also shared several clips of the fireworks. That's all for me today, and I wish all of our listeners around the world and, of course, you a Happy New Year.
Well, thank you so much, G. Happy New Year to you, too. And thanks for that great work going through all the social media posts to tell us what's happening in Dubai. You can follow her on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. And she also tweets for the International Editions team at VOA_IE account. So be sure to follow that, too. My handle is at VOA Stevenson. This is VOA.
News is mobile and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA podcasts a try.
VOANews.com.
Visit our website at VOANews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
This is VOA's International Edition. Days after raising the Iraqi flag over the provincial capital of Ramadi, Iraqi security forces say pockets of resistance of Islamic State fighters in numbers ranging from a few dozen to several hundred still pose a risk in and near the city. The city has been devastated by U.S.-led airstrikes and months of IS occupation. Ambassador James Jeffrey, a veteran diplomat posted to Baghdad and Ankara, now with the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, was recently in Iraq. He tells VOA's Victor Beatty that he's not surprised by the destruction, but believes that Ramadi can make a rapid comeback.
We've seen this before in battles such as Tikrit and to some degree Beji, which go back and forth. This city is primarily under the control of Iraqi forces at this point. They have a huge numerical superiority. They hold terrain, and only a small percent of their forces are good in attacking ISIS. Most of the forces in there can hold terrain once they've gotten in there. So they're just going to continue squeezing the ISIS people, and they will eventually be driven out.
This is a city that has been devastated after months of occupation. It's going to take a long time to rebuild the city. Thousands of homes were reportedly destroyed.
That's true, and that's part of what we're all going to have to deal with ISIS. I was just out in Iraq, and just the cost of keeping people mobilized and keeping refugees housed is costing Iraq, both Kurdistan in the north and the central government in the south, easily $10 billion a year. So destroying ISIS, even if a lot of cities are damaged in the process, is financially cheaper, totally apart from all of the other moral and military and other benefits of it. It's cheaper. I mean, there is no choice. There's no way to destroy these guys without blowing up a lot of buildings, because they, frankly, a lot of the buildings they blow up themselves, no matter how careful the U.S. military is, they wire all of the buildings, or at least most of them. And here's the other thing, Victor. You know, I went into Fallujah a few months after the Marines took it house by house, and most of the city was functioning and back in operation. Now, ISIS may be doing a better job of blowing up buildings as they retreat, a scorched earth policy, but still, I was very impressed with what Fallujah looked like a few months after we went in and took that thing house by house, with a lot of artillery, a lot of air, and a lot of tank fire.
Prime Minister Abadi pledged to retake Mosul 400 kilometers north of Baghdad by next year. Is that overly optimistic?
If the U.S. does not further increase its direct engagement, both in quality, that is the kind of forces we're using, where we're using them, and in quantity, I don't think that's possible. And even then, it's going to be hard because we won't have the same offensive forces. We basically rely primarily on the counterterrorism force in Ramadi and on certain elite units of the Peshmerga in Sinjar. And the Peshmerga really cannot be all that effective in non-Kurdish areas, and most of Mosul is non-Kurdish. And this is one reason why I think that some use of American forces is necessary.
A different perspective comes from Ahmed Ali, a senior fellow at the Institute of Regional and International Studies at American University of Iraq, and says that the strategy that won back Ramadi shows that Iraqis are ready to fight and perhaps less reliance on U.S. ground forces. Flooding, tornadoes, and wildfires in the United States, UK, South America, and Australia. The concentration of these serious weather and natural events during the past month is leading many to ask why. Dr. Michael Mann is the director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University, and he tells VOA's Ira Melman why we're seeing such extreme weather conditions around the world and what might be able to be done about it.
You know, it's a combination of several things. First of all, the vagaries of weather. You know, there's a randomness to weather, and sometimes you get events like this that happen just because of the chance occurrence of, you know, extreme weather. Now, add to that not just an El Nino event, but the strongest El Nino event on record. This is a periodic warming of the tropical Pacific that influences weather patterns around the world. It comes every 4 to 5 years. Well, we are now seeing the largest El Nino event on record. And there's an interesting question to, you know, about what role climate change might be playing there. And what climate change does is it takes events that would have been, you know, extreme events and makes them not just extreme, but unprecedented. So instead of just seeing extreme rainfall events, extreme warm temperatures in parts of North America and parts of Europe, we're seeing record temperatures. We're seeing record flooding. And so climate change is the extra fuel that makes what would have been an extreme weather event an unprecedented weather event. Now, that El Nino effect, as we said, that's a natural phenomenon, but there is an interesting question that scientists are asking about whether climate change might actually be leading to bigger El Nino events, and climate change might be playing a role there. And climate change is taking these extreme events and making them more extreme because it's adding extra heat. It's adding extra moisture to the atmosphere. A warmer atmosphere holds more moisture. That means there's more energy in the atmosphere. And when there's more energy in the atmosphere, you get more extreme weather events.
What do you say to those who assert that this is nothing but cyclical? This has happened before?
It's wrong. Every part of that statement is wrong. And unfortunately, we do live in a sort of a modern environment where misinformation and disinformation is often spread, even though the overwhelming community of scientists across the world, it's the overwhelming consensus of the scientists across the world that climate change is real, it's caused by human activity, it's already having negative impacts on us. While it's true that climate does change naturally, we are seeing rates of change that are unprecedented. We're seeing levels of warmth right now which are unprecedented potentially over many millennia. We have now reached levels of CO2 in the atmosphere. We've crossed 400 parts per million CO2 in the atmosphere for the first time in millions of years.
Dr. Mann, I wish you a happy new year, but you haven't painted the brightest picture at all.
Well, thanks. A happy new year to you as well. And I do want to leave your audience with a little bit of optimism. The Paris Agreement signaled that maybe, just maybe, we can tackle this problem. And there is still time. Some bad stuff will happen. We're already committed to that. But we can make sure that the worst doesn't happen. We can still preserve this world for future generations, but we have to act now. And 2016 is going to be a critical year for making progress on this.
Dr. Michael Mann, director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artist. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English. This year witnessed one of the most popular shows ever at New York City's Metropolitan Museum of Art. The Costume Institute's exhibit, China Through the Looking Glass, opened in May. It was extended for 3 weeks through Labor Day at the end of the summer. International Edition's Sarah Williams spoke in September with Maxwell K. Hearn, Douglas Dillon Chairman of Asian Art at the Met.
The exhibit is actually one of the largest, if not the largest, museum exhibitions ever mounted by the museum, because it occupies something like 30,000 square feet. It's taken over virtually all of the Chinese galleries in the museum for the permanent collection, as well as the permanent galleries for the Costume Institute, and even one small space in the Egyptian wing, so that we are spread out across three floors. And so it's really a vast undertaking. So just from the point of view of scale alone, it is a very grand undertaking.
Yes, I had the privilege of visiting, and I don't recall I've ever been to a Met exhibit that was on three floors like that before.
We wanted to tie the show together. The concept behind the show is to present the inspiration that China has provided to Western designers across several centuries, beginning with chinoiserie in the 17th and 18th century, and coming right down to the present. And we felt it would be very meaningful to place these costumes within the Chinese galleries to juxtapose works of art from the Chinese collections with these Western fashions, to really make the point that various ways of in which Western designers have taken, drawn inspiration from Chinese traditional art.
And it was very striking seeing not only the costumes, but the use of film and music. It really combined a number of media. It was really quite striking.
The premise of the exhibition, which was curated by Andrew Bolton from the Costume Institute, but which we were very happy to collaborate with him and bring the expertise of our Chinese specialists to bear on the show, was that China has been a source of inspiration, starting with export fabrics and blue and white ceramics, and then subsequently, as museum collections developed in the West, these collections became a source of inspiration. And finally, in the 30s and later, cinema was a very important source of giving people an impression about what Chinese life or Chinese fashion was all about. So it became a very significant part of the exhibition to choose films starting in the 1930s that portrayed China either by Western filmmakers or subsequently by Chinese filmmakers themselves.
And a prominent film in the exhibit is some of the sound and some of the film from The Last Emperor.
Yes, so the exhibition begins with a series of galleries that present three ages of Chinese culture. The Imperial Age, which is typified by the dragon robe of the Qing Dynasty emperors. The Republican era, which is typified by the Qi Pao, which is a very slender, close-fitting dress for women. And finally, the Maoist era, where the Mao suit became the one fashion that unified all of China and which in turn had its impact on Western designers. So those three ages are really set forth in the opening sections of the exhibition.
And why do you think this exhibit has been so successful? It was extended for 3 weeks.
I think that China is a subject that people are fascinated by. We recognize that China has become politically and economically a major force on the world stage today, but that there's still a need for us to understand its culture. And the fact that there is this long tradition of imagining China in the West, sometimes it's more fantasy than reality, makes it clear that the West is still struggling to come to a deeper appreciation and understanding of what Chinese culture and what Chinese civilization is all about. But the very fact that China is such a prominent part of the show, I think, has made it enormously popular, not to mention the fact that the dresses themselves are so sumptuous and beautiful. It's clear that people find that very easy to relate to.
You've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at our website at voanews.com. We're also on Twitter. Follow us at @VOA_IE. Couldn't think of a better way to ring in the new year with, you know, our engineer, Zeynep Abdel-Rahman, and our director, Tracy Carter. Thank you both. And thank you for joining us. Come back and visit. Enjoy your day, and hope you have a great new year.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States condemns the terrible attacks carried out by Boko Haram in Nigeria, December 25th to 28th, as well as other recent attacks in Cameroon, Chad, and Niger. In these attacks, Boko Haram killed dozens of innocent people who were targeted as they went about their daily lives, attending service at a mosque, shopping in a neighborhood market, or simply traveling down a road. We extend our deepest condolences to the families and loved ones of the victims. And we stand with the people of Nigeria and the region in the fight against Boko Haram. Boko Haram has no regard for human life. Its vicious attacks against the innocent, including women and children, and its use of children as human bombs prove its true nature as a purveyor of hate and terror. Although Boko Haram may be able to kill innocent people, it cannot succeed in imposing its will on the people of Nigeria and the other countries of the Lake Chad Basin. The people of this region are not cowed by Boko Haram. They continue to demonstrate remarkable resilience and unshaken resolve in living their lives as they work, take care of their families, and go about day-to-day living. The United States remains committed to helping Nigeria and its neighbors counter Boko Haram's senseless acts of terror. Despite much progress over the past year, due in large part to newly bolstered Nigerian and regional efforts, more work remains to ensure the people of Cameroon, Chad, Niger, and Nigeria can live in peace. The conflict has affected the lives of communities across the Lake Chad Basin region, with some 2.5 million internally displaced people and more than 170,000 Nigerian refugees forced to flee their homes. The United States provides advisors, intelligence, training, logistical support, and equipment to our African partners as they work to defeat Boko Haram. We also support those affected by Boko Haram's violence through ongoing humanitarian aid and victim support services. The United States will continue working with our partners in the region to identify new opportunities to support their efforts to stop Boko Haram's wanton violence and restore order in the Lake Chad Basin region.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA editorial.